Dad, you're pushing my buttons.
I was going to talk right off the top about all the shootings that have been happening in North America. There was actually one yesterday, just over here at the hospital. I didn't know that when I was preparing for today, so it's very fresh in the minds of people in Simcoe. I think, like all of you, that the continuing report of shootings involving young men in North America is a sign that something deeply fundamental is wrong in our society. It is further disturbing that a group of young men who end up recovering in hospital from a gunshot wound would rather hide their attacker's identity than help police apprehend one that killed their friends. So what do you think's going on in neighborhoods? What's going on in the homes of this town, this province, this nation, this continent, if you like? There may be many causes for this violence, but I think Bill Glass is right when he writes in Christianity Today the following article about the state of youth in the United States. What is our country's biggest problem? A lack of father's blessing, he writes. The FBI studied the 17 kids who shot their classmates in towns like Paddock, Kentucky, Pearl, Mississippi, and Littleton, Colorado. And all 17 shooters had one thing in common. They had a father problem. Glass continues, I see it so much, it's just unbelievable. There's something about it when a man doesn't get along with his father. It makes him mean. It makes him dangerous. It, of course, makes him angry. On the day before Father's Day, this is Glass continuing to talk, I was in North Carolina at a juvenile detention center or prison. I ate lunch with three boys, and I asked the first boy, is your dad coming to see you tomorrow on Father's Day? And he said, no, he's not coming. I said, why not? And he said, he's in prison. I asked the second boy the same question, and I got the same answer. I asked the third one why his dad wasn't coming, and he said, he just got out of prison about 9 months ago, and he's doing really good, and I'm proud of my father. He's really going to be a good dad to me, and he's going to go straight. I could tell he was protesting so strongly because something still wasn't right. So I said, how many times has he come here to visit you since he got out 9 months ago? Can you guess how many? He said, he hasn't made it up yet. Why not? Well, he lives way, way away. Where does he live? He lives in Durham. And Durham was about 2 hours away from that detention center. And the author says, I had come 1,500 miles to see this boy. His dad couldn't come 2 hours, Glass says. And Glass concludes, there are a lot of fathers who are really deserters in their kids' lives. When I'm in a prison, I always challenge the inmates to bless their kids. If you want your kid to stay out of prison, bless them. It might be presumptuous of me to suggest that all the violence we're seeing is directly connected to a lack of fatherly presence, but I suspect that it's a major contributing cause. There seems to be a great deal of young, angry men and probably women in our society who will use whatever methods they deem necessary to build significance into their lives, even if it means killing off a rival. Where are the fathers who bless their sons and their daughters? Where are they? I think it's imperative that I reveal something to you today that you may not be aware of. When Jesus came and shared the gospel, and later the apostles continued this ministry, What they were preaching was a fundamental shift in their society and in their culture. Much of the instruction given by Jesus and the Apostle Paul, and also other early leaders in the church, called believers to a lifestyle and relationship model that deviated dramatically from Judaism and Roman society. And nowhere is this more pronounced than in Paul's words that we read today regarding children. Will you notice, please, that Paul does something absolutely startling in the first part of this passage? He's addressing not the parents. He's speaking to whom? He's talking to the children. And this is very significant because, as we know, this letter is one that would have been read publicly to the congregation. And that begs the question of who was present in that fellowship. Children. They were there. Children were in the midst of whatever the church was doing. This in itself may have been radical. Because children in Roman society and in Judaism were often relegated to just being outsiders looking into what was going on. Remember that famous story where Jesus was sitting somewhere and he welcomed the children to him and the disciples tried to drive them away? Do you remember that story? It was as if the disciples were saying to the children and anyone else who was listening, stay back, children. This is adult stuff. Don't bother Jesus when he's speaking to adults. The presence of children reveals to us that the gospel was beginning to break down social barriers between people. In the early churches, men, women, children, rich, poor, slave, and free, they mixed freely, or at least were beginning to. This free interaction among groups that in Roman society would have been separated caused no end of strife for the emerging church. If you read Paul's letters very carefully, it's clear that a great majority of the instruction that he sends to the early church is directed at the Christian culture clashing with Roman or Jewish culture. So we find big questions about circumcision or eating food to idols or the treatment of slavery. And for today's consideration, family relationships. In the early church, which had no written gospel yet, much of the written instruction they had came from where? The Old Testament. And as time went on, Paul's letters and other letters were also used to instruct the congregation. The learning of the Ten Commandments was a fundamental task for all believers, and so the instruction of the children in these commands was also critical. And I'll tell you what, they stressed, honor your father and mother. There was a problem, however, as Paul reveals. What does it mean to honor your father and mother? It is a problem we have even today in trying to understand what does it mean to honor our fathers and mothers. The Hebrew word is tima. What do you think it means? I think if I surveyed those gathered here, the most common response that I might get is to honor. I heard respect someone over there. But honor means to obey. So to rephrase the commandment, a lot of people would say, obey your father and mother. And such a definition has led to some very interesting developments in family dynamics, hasn't it? If, as a Christian, you believe your children should obey you to fulfill a command to them, you have some preconceived ideas, don't you? Some preconceived expectations. As a child, if I say to my child, do the dishes, clean up your room, or whatever, then I expect that command to be honored. If a child refuses, we can get angry at such defiance. We might even quote the commandment in the Ten Commandments to get them to respond more favorably to our orders. The problem is, however, that translating the Hebrew word tima to mean obey is inaccurate. It's also misleading. There is, of course, an element of obedience implied here, but the Hebrew word tima, or honor, means so much more. It's a richer word than that. The word honor here means, more accurately, to respect and to esteem. And you know, our friends from other cultures, primarily from the East, will understand this without any difficulty whatsoever. In their cultures, honoring one's parents or elders is a natural part of their social custom. When you fail to honor those who are your elders, it brings disgrace on you as an individual. It can even bring disgrace on your family. Lenski writes, honor means the form of love one assumes towards those who are placed over us by God. So when we obey our parents, what we're really doing is showing our love to the ones God has placed in authority over us. However, this does not give parents a license to abuse their authority. In Paul's day, children were often treated like chattel. They were commodities to be used, sometimes abused, for the gain of the parent. In Roman society, a father was the supreme authority and was never to be questioned. And Paul doesn't question the structure, but he questions the motive and the attitude of fathers. In Roman society, a child's opinion or feelings were absolutely irrelevant. But Paul speaks to this by saying that a father must now consider the feelings of his children. That's radical stuff. If you want your children to respect and esteem and even love you, then you better try and make it easy for them to do so. In Paul's writings and in Jesus' example and words, when you are the stronger one in the relationship, you have certain obligations to the weaker one. In Matthew 25, Jesus even links judgment to our care of the least of these. Elsewhere, he warns not to abuse little ones, causing them to sin. Specifically, Paul warns fathers to not goad or exasperate or make your children angry by making unreasonable demands on them. The point Paul is trying to make is that if a father was to overcorrect or constantly make unreasonable demands of his children, that those children might lose heart. Now, for an example of that, all you need to do is examine the life of one of the biggest names in the manufacturing history of our continent, Henry Ford. You know that it was Ford who introduced the Model T automobile that shaped not only the economy, but the values of 20th century America. In a 2005 biography of Ford by Marjorie Kagan, we can read how this gifted man, he was gifted, was undone by his own success. She writes, Ford loved the ordinary folk, and they loved him back. By 1920, half of all cars on U.S. roads were Fords. But it wasn't just cars that Ford was selling. He preached a new gospel out to a public that had been raised on Puritan values of delayed gratification and self-control. Ford believed that if you had money, you should spend it. And that workers should use their income to buy products to improve their lives. Products like his Model T, right? Seen as a hero, for making it possible for the average family to own a car. Ford's opinion was sought out in every area of life. He was asked his opinions on world peace and marriage and child care. And Key continues in her biography of Ford with these words. The adulation of others ultimately convinced Ford that he was infallible. It led him to some ruinously bad decisions. It blinded him to his own hypocrisy as he preached family values and old-fashioned virtues and yet kept a mistress. It may also have driven him to destroy his only child. The older Ford, offended by his son's gentle style and superior education, ruthlessly undercut him at every turn, only to mourn grievously when Edsel, his young son, died quite young. Ford's last days on this earth were very sorrowful. On a visit to the house where he had lived as a newlywed, he told his chauffeur, I've got a lot of money, and I'd give every penny of it right now to be here with Mrs. Ford. I'm convinced that we're in grave danger as a society of raising a whole generation of boys and girls, men and women, who are absolutely exasperated by their father. A generation of young men and women who are driven to despair by fathers who respond to their children entrusted to them in two ways. They either drive them to despair by placing unrealistic expectations on them to achieve goals that are simply not attainable, or they are simply absent physically or emotionally. Is it any wonder then that there's a growing number of people in our society that find this day, this Father's Day, the most difficult day of the year? Not only do we have people who don't know who their father is, but even if they know their dads, they cannot relate to their fathers in a healthy way. I personally have had grown men and women talk about how their own fathers drove them emotionally away because they were never good enough to meet their father's expectations. I've tried to comfort adults who to this day, many years later, cannot think of their fathers without experiencing gut-wrenching pain, tremendous bouts of sorrow. Not because their father died, but because of how their fathers treated them. You dig a little deeper into these troubled souls and you discover that loving their fathers is not the issue. Since even some of the most abused kids in this planet still claim they love their fathers. The problem is that they are so emotionally scarred that they cannot move into the future without first reconciling the past. The sad part is that even with extensive therapy, some people never learn to cope with their personal pain. In an interesting little book, Five People You Meet in Heaven, maybe some of you read it, author Mitch Albom tells the story there of Eddie. He's a maintenance worker at a seaside carnival. After Eddie dies, he journeys through heaven and he sees his father. And the memories of their painful relationship just come flooding back. And Albom describes the effect of fathers on sons this way. All parents damage their children, cannot be helped. Youth, like pristine glass, absorb the prints of their handlers. Some parents smudge, others crack, and a few shatter childhoods completely into jagged little pieces beyond repair. The hands on Eddie's childhood glass then was hard and calloused and red with anger. And he went through his younger years being whacked and lashed and beaten by his father. This was the second damage done after the one of neglect. The damage of violence had got so that Eddie could tell by the thump of the footsteps coming down the hall how hard he was going to get hit. And through it all, despite it all, Eddie privately adored this man. Because sons will adore their fathers even through the worst behavior. This is how they learn devotion, the album says. Before they can devote themselves to God or to a woman, a boy will devote himself to his father. Even foolishly. Even without explanation. As fathers and mothers, grandparents, and as a church, we have an enormous responsibility to our children. I mean all the children entrusted to this community called Norfolk County. Our calling includes a gospel command to care for those who are younger and smaller and more vulnerable and whose feelings can be so easily damaged. This is especially true of our children. Can we not commit ourselves this day to stop exasperating our children by driving them to despair over unreasonable demands? Can we also stop exasperating our children by being absent both physically and emotionally? It's time for Christ followers to step up to the plate. Because the world isn't going to do it. No child is expendable in God's kingdom. Nor should they ever be expendable in our hearts either. May this Father's Day be a new beginning for young men and women so that the biggest issue they have to face on this day, this Father's Day, is what tie or chocolate stuff.